Before that, a new series, Creative Genius, where Ian Peacock unravels the science, psychology and myth behind creativity. He starts by asking the apparently simple question, what on earth is it?
Creativity, oh, I don't know. I think we all have it. I think we all have to find it.
Creativity is do something that other people haven't thought of.
Creativity is making something out of nothing. I think it's possible. I think most people do it every day without realising it.
But nothing is nothing.
Not necessarily. To create something, there must have been nothing first for it to be created.
It's imagination and passion put together. Creation always has to do with passion. It's something you really want to... You want to go further, so you have to be passionate to be creative.
Creativity is something that you make your own.
I guess it's going past the normal realms of conforming to whatever the obvious idea is. It's kind of taking it that step further.
Creativity is imagining the unimaginable. Blah, blah, blah.
The more you try to define it, the more unimaginable it gets.
The act of bringing into being or form out of nothing.
Says the Oxford English Dictionary, helpfully. Shakespeare had a go too and didn't really get much further.
The spell in which imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown.
We all know it when we see it. It's there in Da Vinci, Darwin, Mozart, Einstein, Jane Austen, Shakespeare, David Beckham even. But it's not quite that obvious. Van Gogh was only defined as creative after he died. Before that, he was considered mad. I know the feeling. And I wonder whether the creative prowess of Tracy Emin or Damien Hirst would have been recognised in, say, the 14th century, or whether they and their beds and stuffed animals would have been burnt at the stake. Then there's the question of whether creativity has to be useful or conscious or even human. Can you have a creative gerbil or an arty laptop? Is it connected to intelligence or its very opposite? And is it about sheer ideas or skill in implementing them? Is John Cage's silent composition, 4 minutes 33, as creative as Beethoven's Fifth? Then there's the question of where our creativity comes from and where it thrives. When do we get our best ideas? Where are we? And what are we doing when they just kind of pop up?
Dropping off to sleep, I think, probably.
Just before sleeping, because I'm relaxed.
I believe your ideas are always in your subconscious, and I get my best ideas as I'm falling asleep. They flow more easily to the surface.
Sleeping? Dreaming?
Bed.
In bed.
I had one last night, 3 o'clock in the morning, woke up, and I got very creative and can get back to sleep for about an hour and a half.
When I get up, just sort of go off into my little world. In the shower, usually.
Taking a bath.
They come through the letterbox.
That's very often.
Your ideas do. Yeah. Most of your ideas come through the letterbox.
Yes, yes, yeah. Really.
Are there any prizes for the right answers?
No.
Oh, dear.
On the train?
On trains, yeah, on trains, buses.
Probably on the way to work.
When I'm walking the dog. It's called Little Fur and it's a Jack Russell. You stop doing it, you stop thinking about anything else, and then it kind of eventually hits you.
Used to be when I was walking the dog, when I had a dog.
My best ideas are really when I'm walking about. I'm just meandering, really.
Walking around.
When I'm walking, I get my ideas more than when I'm sitting somewhere.
I think sometimes a beach.
I think mine's probably on the sunbed. The weather is the light, I'm illuminated with creativity, I don't know, but I just spend time thinking about creative things as opposed to other things that worry me.
When I'm chilling to music.
I get my best ideas from my mind.
Inside my head. Now that's the best place I find for ideas. I do not go around hoping to see a good idea on the pavement. I rely on just getting them from my head.
One psychologist suggested creativity happens in
the bath, the bed, or the bus.
But it's far from predictable.
My stories run up and bite me in the leg. I respond by writing down everything that goes on during the bite. When I finish, the idea lets go and runs off.
Author Ray Bradbury. Most artists seem to agree that inspiration bites them in the oddest and least convenient of places. Novelist Jamila Siddiqui.
It tends to be in the midst of mundane tasks, quite often in the shower with shampoo in my hair, more often than not scrubbing the kitchen floor. I can tell you where I never am when ideas come to me. I'm never at the computer hoping to have an idea.
sometimes I get bored by listening to some lecture on English literature, and I noticed that quite often I got an idea for a poem. I almost began to think that, you know, I should seek out situations where I'm bored and trapped in order to see if I get ideas.
Poet Tom Paulin, possibly suffering during boring lectures from what Socrates called the divine madness of the muses.
I've almost had this sense that it wasn't my voice that I was wanting to speak, but there was this other voice that was trying to get through that came from somewhere else and wasn't me personally.
I was writing a perfectly good chapter for my current novel, and this other guy appeared in the chapter and wouldn't leave, and he still hasn't left, and he's superfluous to the plot, and I don't know what I'm going to do with him, but, you know, he's there, and he's a weirdo, and he's a kind of muse, actually. He's become a muse. I have these long conversations with him, like, you know, what am I going to do with you? I mean, I've got to resolve this ending, and you don't fit in anywhere, and I know what the editors are going to say. They're going to say this subplot doesn't work, so why are you here? And it's like he's there because he just needs to be. He needs to interact with the characters I've created, but my other characters have started noticing him, so I can't ignore him even if I want to.
The classical Greek idea of a muse, a mystical, inspirational figure, continues in the 21st century. Fashion designers still have muses, human ones rather than water sprites, obviously. And most creative people know that weird feeling when a character takes over or their pen seems guided by another hand. In this programme, I'm going to meet the people who believe they can capture the muses and access the ultimate elixir, the DNA of creativity. Not artists, but scientists and psychologists who ask questions many creative types might feel a little threatened by. Like, is creativity unique to humans or not?
Lot number 29 almost needs no introduction. It's unique in the sale in being the only piece of primate art we're selling today.
Three paintings by a chimpanzee have been sold at an auction in London for £12,000. The buyer was an American who describes himself as an enthusiast of modern and contemporary painting.
It is an abstract work in tempera on paper, and according to Dr. Morris, Congo was very, very deliberate in where he placed his colors, where he made his patterns, and essentially, once he had finished the composition, he laid aside his brush and refused to go any further.
Desmond Morris's chimp Congo did produce what looked like modern abstract art in the 1950s. Picasso loved it. But was it genuine creativity, or did it just resemble it, and does it really matter anyway? When I dropped in on the Gibbon enclosure at London Zoo, the monkeys did appear to be displaying some Turner Prize-winning behaviour. Their keeper, or muse perhaps, is Joe Cook.
Some of the primates which show the most creative behaviour are obviously the great apes, and we've got chimpanzees, gorillas here. The chimpanzees occasionally like drawing with chalk on the floor. They also play around with buckets of water and things like that. Again, with the gorillas, they tend to fish things with sticks, so if we drop something outside the bars that they want to get, say some raisins for example, they'll get a stick and try and pull them under the bars with them. We also have some lesser apes. We have some gibbons here. They're perhaps less creative, but they do like playing with bottles which are filled with sunflower seeds, and they're not so interested in getting the seeds to eat, but they do like shaking them to make a lot of sound. So they behave like that sometimes.
And early human creativity wasn't that different from the chimp version. Steve Mython is Professor of Early Prehistory at the University of Reading.
Our prehistoric ancestors, like Homo ergaster 1 million years ago, or our close relatives like the Neanderthals of 40,000 years ago, they were making some very sophisticated stone artifacts from amorphous lumps of stone. So I think there's a lot of creativity in that process. But it's a creativity which allows them to make the same thing again and again over tens, hundreds of thousands of years. So it's a peculiar type of creativity, not the type we normally think of in terms of art and music.
It was only when modern humans arrived on the scene that creativity as we know it was born. And art, apparently for art's sake, appeared on cave walls.
The very first art objects come from Blombos Cave in southern Africa. They're on small pieces of ochre stone, and they have geometric designs engraved in them. Now, these are deliberately engraved symbols, quite different to anything we've had in the past. We have no idea what they mean, how these objects were used, There's also simply a great deal of red ochre within these cave deposits, both found as powder, as pigment, and as nodules of ochre that have clearly been rubbed on either objects, or most likely on bodies, for body painting. So, in one respect, it's not that striking, but it's clearly the precedence for the great works of cave art that we find in Europe, beginning at around 35,000 years ago, after Homo sapiens had dispersed out of Africa into those northern Ice Age environments. And of course, those paintings are just mind-blowing every time you see them, no matter how many times. One is reminded of the astonishing creature that humans are, because even these prehistoric people living in Ice Age conditions with a Stone Age technology are able to create these remarkable paintings of bison and deer and mammoth using the natural found pigments, and not only paint them in such technical precision, but also imbue them with such emotive powers and feelings. It's something we can connect with. You know, we come from an entirely different culture, but we can immediately see these and be moved by them in the way that we'd be moved by music or art produced in the 21st century.
Steve Mython believes the muse which first inspired human creativity wasn't anything mystical, supernatural, or shamanistic. It was quite simply language.
I think language underlies our creative abilities, because language isn't only a means of communication. It changes the way we think. And I think language was the mechanism that allows people to combine different types of ideas in their minds, and also from other people's minds, to come up with new types of thoughts. Let's take the Neanderthals, who I don't think had language. I think they knew a great deal about the natural world. They knew a great deal about people. They knew a great deal about artifacts and animals and mountains, but they had great difficulty in bringing these different types of information together within their minds. And I think one reason they didn't do that is that they lacked this sort of internal speech that we have today. When language evolved with modern humans, it provided this internal speech, and I think that allows an ability to combine stores of knowledge, these ways of thinking in our minds, to create brand new things. And let me give you an idea. I don't think Neanderthals would have understood metaphor. I think if you told them that my son is brave as a lion, they couldn't actually appreciate exactly what they meant, because lion and humans are very different entities. But because of the way our minds work, influenced by language, we can put these ideas and different entities together and come up with new concepts.
Neanderthals were obviously as thick as two short planks, a metaphor they wouldn't understand. Language is, of course, endlessly creative, as linguist Noam Chomsky argued. So far today, whether you like it or not, you've created sentences that have never been uttered before. Consider yourself an entrepreneurial Neanderthal. And for many authors, writing new sentences, creating worlds and characters, is a thrilling, almost transcendental experience.
It feels like somebody's taken your hand and is guiding it. There is a feeling that you've been taken over, something has to pass through you very quickly. It's not a feeling of pain, there is no anxiety, you're simply there being, and you have to be very empty. And what keeps you going in that process is you want to know what happens next.
Another novelist, Beryl Bainbridge, gets herself into this rapt state by working right up to the deadline, day and night, locking herself away in an upstairs room, smoking and drinking whiskey.
The alcohol only came into it about 5 years ago, only when I get stuck. And what I found was that it made you write. Then you had a sleep and you looked at it and it was rubbish, but there was something there. You could work from it. I don't know where the phrase comes from, but life gets the boot in. We are all squashed by things, you know, by worries and you know, how to behave and God knows what else, and, you know, doing things properly and keeping things clean. And so a drink is a release. It releases. You get rid of the inhibitions. You think, oh, to hell with that, you know, and you're not so cautious.
And this struggle between inhibition and creativity has a physical parallel inside Beryl's head as her brain cells battle it out. Neuroscientist Dr. Mark Lithgow of Great Ormond Street studies the inner workings of brains as they produce creative ideas.
there are two processes that go on in the brain. One's called excitation and one's called inhibition. And literally that happens on a brain cell level. There are some brain cells that are excitatory and some brain cells that are inhibitory, and they compete on a second-by-second basis, literally for every thought, every action that you do. And you can imagine a situation that if you were able to take away some of the inhibitory effects, that something could bubble to the surface, there would be more excitation, and therefore you would have a change related to that. So possibly what's happening is there's literally less inhibitory effects, you're more disinhibited, that allow you to make more connections than you would have done previously.
So in order to be more creative, you somehow need to disinhibit your brain?
I definitely think that people that are more disinhibited appear to be more creative. Now, what's more recently it's been shown, people that had low levels of latent inhibition, that means that they allowed more irrelevant stimuli to come through into sort of their daily working practice, were more creative. So there seems to be this association between being disinhibited, as it were, and more creative. The ability to allow more things to come through, things that we would normally perceive as completely irrelevant.
And scientists apparently have to shake off their inhibitions too. The mind boggles. Science may not seem all that bohemian, but it is creative, involving lateral thinking and dreaming up impossible-seeming problems and solutions.
If at first an idea is not absurd, then there is no hope for it,
said Einstein, who used to imagine himself straddling beams of light.
Imagination is more important than knowledge.
And Lisa Randall agrees. She's professor of theoretical physics at Harvard University. She finds metaphors very useful, and she's argued rather creatively that human beings are possibly living like water droplets on a giant shower curtain hanging somewhere in multidimensional space.
I think one aspect that enters into creativity is sort of an ability to simultaneously process many different pieces of information, many different approaches, many different ideas. I actually think that science kind of, it gives back at some extent. I mean, one of the really nice aspects of the work that we did is that in some ways the universe is more creative than we are. It's so amazing because in working on some of these physical theories about extra dimensions of space, the equations gave us phenomena that we hadn't actually even been trying to find, that we could have infinite additional dimensions of space. That was never thought possible. It was always thought they had to be tiny. But actually, as a byproduct of some other problem I was working on, I discovered that this could actually be possible, or the fact that we could actually live in this pocket of three-dimensional space in an extra-dimensional universe. Again, we didn't set out to find that, but that's what the equations gave us. So I think this just a whole new world out there of ideas that participating in science allows you to access.
So it's all about disinhibiting our brains, preventing them from filtering too much stuff out, rewiring and reprogramming our brain cells and pathways so we can tune into our blocked-off muses. And if it's all about tweaking our mechanisms, then surely computers could be creative too, an unromantic prospect which I find scarier than arty chimps. Surely a computer has no past, no sensibilities. Surely a computer couldn't paint the Sistine Chapel or write a love song. Geraint Wiggins is Professor of Computational Creativity at Goldsmiths College London, and he's trying to develop a truly creative computer, a sort of Microsoft Michelangelo.
A lot of people throughout the world spend a lot of their time analysing the creative outputs of artists. And that's really what we're doing with this computational creativity work in many ways. We're looking at how we can reproduce what artists do. And in order to do that, we have to study them in great depth and we have to understand them. So in one sense, what we're doing is computationalizing the study of the humanities. Computers are good at following rules. And if we can understand the rules of what a human creator does, then in principle we can write a program which embodies those rules and which therefore embodies the same behaviour. It's a simulation. It really is a simulation. There's nothing to say that it's doing what it's doing in the same way that a person does it necessarily. The question is, does it really make any difference whether it's the real thing, that's to say the human biological organism, or a computer doing something which is indistinguishable from that thing in its own way? Why should that be any less creative?
Fitter. Happier, more productive, comfortable, not drinking too much, regular...
Geraint's fascinated by the idea that a computer could compose music which could arouse emotions and memories in human beings.
I've brought along here an example of a piece of music which was produced by a program called Choral. Choral was written by a guy called Kemal Ebcholu, working in America. And its task is to duplicate one of the tasks which was close to the heart of Johann Sebastian Bach. Bach was interested in producing new versions of hymn tunes to be sung in church, and he produced very many of these chorale melodies which were harmonized for soprano, alto, tenor and bass. So he's given the tune, that's a traditional tune, and the idea is to produce the other three parts so that this can be sung by real people in church. That was what Bach was doing. So that seemed to be a reasonable task to set a computer to see how far it could get.
So Ebcholu took a basic hymn tune, put it into the computer and said, right, write some harmonies which will make it sound like Bach.
That's correct.
Can we have a listen?
Certainly.
Lovely. But Garrett decided the ultimate test of computer composition was to see if computer-generated music could inspire emotion and creative storytelling in children. He asked his computer to improvise an original horror film score.
We looked at how film composers write their music. We looked at harmonic theory, and we built a system which would use random numbers to generate the chords, the melody, the rhythms, and those random numbers were constrained to lie in certain random areas by the scariness parameter. So
Scariness parameter?
Yes, there's a scariness parameter, which is essentially a slider control. The idea is simply that the more gothic-sounding stuff can happen when the scariness parameter is high. Less and less of the gothic-sounding stuff is likely to happen as the parameter goes down.
I was inspired by the computer's creative efforts to improvise my very own terrifying short story. Okay, very gothic. I can almost sense a pulsing, the pulse of the heartbeat as the children go through the graveyard. And they're very, very afraid. It's night, it's dusk, it's about to get dark. They walk through the gravestones, up the gravel path, through the lich gate, into the darkened church. What is weird is there's nobody there, but the candles are on. The candles turn blue. Up in the organ area, there is a spectral ghoul. And the ghoul is howling as if in pain, and it shouts, "Rescue me, rescue me, I am Ebenezer." And the children do a prayer. They kind of do an exorcism of some sort, and then go out of the churchyard. And there's an old man in the churchyard with a black cat, and the old man goes up to a gravestone with a flower, places it on the gravestone, and the gravestone is of Ebenezer Snodgrass. And it's as if the whole... And if the scriptwriters from Scooby-Doo are listening, I think that speaks for itself. After calming down, I decided to put the computer composer to the test and invite a human music critic to have a listen, then describe the composer behind the tune. My victim was Tom Service. That's it, Tom. What did you actually make of it?
There were some nice bits of voice leading. There was a nice bit of counterpoint in it, in the middle parts. Yeah, no, there was creativity there, certainly. But this is not the great individualistic creativity of a romantic composer.
I see. Do you think you could actually try and get inside the composer's head for us?
I think in both of those pieces, it's very hard to get into the composer's head, because the first piece, the sort of church-like piece, is so generic that you would just say it sounds like an exercise. So therefore, it could be a raving psychopath who wrote it. It could be the nicest person in the world. Impossible to tell. With the second one, I guess there's more expressive potential. So you might, so again, the person who wrote it, you might say, could be a sentimental person, perhaps somebody prone to feeling, somebody, an empathetic person, possibly. But again, I would still say they could still be a raving nutter. It's difficult to tell.
Well, Tom, I actually have news for you. The composer was a computer.
That fits, actually, with the kind of things I was thinking about those pieces, that they should be composed by computers. Of course, I can say that with hindsight, can't I? But what you had in the second piece, for example, that throbbing bass and the lamenting tune, you have a lot of the signs of sadness, but they're used in such an incompetent way that there seems to be a very little genuine feeling behind them. It's a very interesting sort of conundrum, because when we're hearing it, we automatically, because it's music, we ascribe human agency to it, because we associate music above all with being a human activity. So it's sort of disconcerting to imagine that a computer could do it.
There's no doubt that the output that chorale produces is about the level of a first-year music student. But how many first-year music students are there? You know, this is what we have here is a computer program which is capable of performing a difficult, knowledge-based task which only a tiny proportion of the human population can even begin to do. Now, I think that's quite creative. It may not be as creative as the great man himself, but I still think it's creative. The fact that these systems at the moment are not very good doesn't mean that they can't be good in future. When a three-year-old begins to draw, he or she is probably not the world's greatest artist, but he or she may become the world's greatest artist later on. We have a very long way to go before we understand the kinds of things that a creative artist does, or that a creative scientist does, and we have even further to go before we can build the computer models which will embody those behaviours.
What computers cannot have is inspiration. But then on the other hand, what is a computer? What you and I are referring to today as a computer would have taken some explaining to our great-grandmothers. And if I had said to my great-great-grandfather, who was probably a wizard at chess somewhere in North India, if I had said, look, Grandad, I played chess with my computer and it beat me, he would have been pretty flabbergasted. So I think, you know, futuristic thinking is very difficult because we are so limited by the concepts of the present time.
How would the machine know how to do it? I think the only reason for writing at all is that you're creating the past. You're reliving it again through words.
And a computer wouldn't have that?
No. All a computer's supposed to do is just make it so you can see the letters.
So if we can program computers to be creative, can we program ourselves to switch off our inhibitions and switch on the creative parts of our brains to unlock our inner genius? In the next programme, I'll be asking whether creative genius is for an elite or whether it's nestling there in all of us, just waiting to be unleashed. I'll be setting off on a quest for Xanadu.
The studies that we're getting now are starting to indicate that creativity, a lot of it's innate, that something happens to the brain that stops something being inhibited and releases something, and you can literally become more creative. So I think we'll get an awful lot closer to a theory of understanding creativity, and once we understand it, well, then maybe we can improve it.
And then go out of the churchyard, and there's an old man in the churchyard with a black cat, and the old man goes up to a gravestone with a flower, places it on the gravestone, and the gravestone is of Ebenezer Snodgrass. And it's as if the whole story has come to a conclusion and it ends happily ever after. What the heck was going on there?
Creative Genius was presented by Ian Peacock. The producer was Pamela Rutherford.